This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kooser. It's been more than a year since the governors of Connecticut and New York closed schools due to the pandemic. As restrictions began to ease, school districts scrambled to come up with innovative options to teach students at a distance or safely in person. Well, now schools in our region are fully open, but things are not quite back to what might be considered normal. So what happened during that year of learning during a pandemic? Did students get the education they needed, or was it a lost year or something in between? And what happens now? We turn to Emily Palin for some insights about these questions. She's the executive director of Connecticut RISE Network in New Haven. RISE released a report in February on the impact of remote learning in Connecticut high schools. Ms. Palin joins us on the phone. Welcome to The Full Story.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Certainly. First of all, could you tell us something about RISE Network? You collaborate with several school districts throughout the state, correct?
That's exactly right. So RISE represents a Connecticut-based nonprofit organization, and we have the privilege of collaborating with public high schools and districts around the state in a network for school improvement. So we work together in pursuit of this shared mission to ensure all RISE high school students graduate with a plan and the skills and confidence to achieve college and career success.
Your February report, how many students were involved in that study? And if you can tell me which high schools they attended, please do that as well.
Absolutely. So the report itself reflected over 12,000 students in our state, and it included 9 different high schools spanning from north to south, including Manchester, Hartford, East Hartford, Middletown, Naugatuck, Meriden, New Haven, Norwalk, and Stamford.
Wow, quite a range. And in that group, how many students were enrolled in remote learning, I guess entirely remote learning, and how many took a hybrid action or option with some learning at home, some learning in the classroom?
So one of the things that we were really interested to try to shine a light on through the report is exactly that question of students had that, their families and students had that option, and what percentage of families chose remote versus hybrid learning. And in that sample size of over 12,000 students, we found that 37% of students chose the entirely remote or online option, and 63% with the hybrid format of some form of in-person instruction. And really interestingly, since we released that study in February, we've been trying to follow those trends. As you mentioned, as schools are reopening slowly, have those decisions changed over time? And we've actually only seen a 1 or 2 percentage point change or shift in that dynamic of remote versus hybrid enrollment.
Were you able to discern what kind of tools the families had in deciding which option to take, which kind of learning, in person or hybrid? Did you get an impression that the families really had what they needed to know to make an informed choice?
So one of the things that we were really interested to do in our process was not just look at the quantitative data to understand what were the enrollment decisions looking like across the 9 schools and how are students faring in terms of their academic success so far this year. We know that the quantitative data only tell a part of the story. So we also surveyed families to understand exactly that dynamic that you're describing. It's a complex choice, and how did families go about making that decision? And we found that our districts have done a really nice job in the backdrop of a really complex and challenging set of circumstances to help families to understand their options, and most importantly, help families understand it is their choice to make on behalf of their students. So in that family survey, it was interesting to see that 100% of the families who had chosen the remote or online option, 100% of them cited safety concerns for their children. And we have to honor and respect that. If that is the feeling and sentiment that families have, we then need to meet that demand and offer a rich option for students who choose the remote format.
Do you think that meant that those families had the information they needed to make an informed choice? Sometimes when a choice is given on any topic. There are those who would prefer that they get some sort of consultation or some more information before making that choice.
I would say, as with most things this past year, probably it was imperfect, but I feel pretty confident that every family made the decision in the best way that they knew how on behalf of their families and their children. And of course, it was imperfect in that in September, when families were first faced with that decision, we didn't really know what schools would look like, what that reopening exactly would feel, and the experience would be for students. But again, I have absolute confidence that districts did their best to share the options in a transparent and timely way, and then families, again, made the best decision that they could on behalf of their students.
One of the key findings in the report was about the number of students who were falling behind in their studies. And I believe the report indicated that had doubled?
That's right, yes. So when we released this report, really we were trying to understand the enrollment and learning trends during the first half of this school year during the pandemic. And really, I think it's important to know that the impetus for this report stemmed from conversations we had been having with educators, families, and students, and really recognizing, as you're describing, that the pandemic was and is still having effects on student engagement and academic success. And before we released this study and even really engaged in this process, we had been hearing these anecdotal stories about lower attendance, decreases in class participation and work completion, higher rates of course failure. And we really wanted to dive in to understand the fuller picture. And that's where we took a look at the quantitative data, again, to understand those enrollment decisions between hybrid and remote learning, as well as how are students doing in their classes during the first portion of the year in terms of being on track or passing enough courses to promote on time to graduation. And exactly as you described, we saw a significant dip in the percentage of students in all grade levels 9 through 12 who are on track in their courses, meaning that they are projected to earn the credits that they need to promote to the next grade level or graduate on time. So that definitely is concerning for us when we think about how our students are faring this year.
And maybe drilling down just a bit more in determining whether or not a student is on track. How is that measured?
Absolutely. So on track status means that students are passing enough courses to qualify for on-time promotion. So off-track students, on the other hand, then are at risk of being retained because they don't have enough credits, for example, to move from 9th grade to 10th grade, or they might not have enough credits to graduate on time if that student is a senior.
And you found, according to this report, you found that students enrolled in remote learning were less likely to be on track to advance to the next grade level compared to students who chose a hybrid model of learning?
That's right. So what we found, two findings taken together that were particularly interesting. One speaks to your earlier question around those enrollment decisions. And again, more than a third of our families chose remote or entirely online learning. And that we saw that female students, students of color, special education students, those populations were more likely to choose remote learning. And then, like you mentioned, we saw that remote learners were far more likely to be off track in their courses compared to their peers in the hybrid model. So those two data points taken together do create concern for us about widening opportunity gaps for historically marginalized populations in our state.
And the achievement gap, you mentioned opportunity gap, but this trend could widen what's typically or traditionally known as the achievement gap between groups of students.
That's right. And at RISE, we oftentimes talk about the opportunity gaps as opposed to achievement gaps, because we know that all students, regardless of family income, race, ethnicity, gender, English learner, or special education status, can and will achieve at high levels when all of our systems are designed to support student success. And we also know that prior to the pandemic, Connecticut has had some of the worst opportunity gaps in the country comparing high-income students to their less affluent peers. So like you, we really wanted to understand how the pandemic might be widening or perpetuating these gaps, particularly because we know that the pandemic is having disproportionate effects on communities of color and low-income students and families.
The school year is really just ending for most students in K through 12. Mm-hmm. When will we know, do you think, what effect the pandemic really has had in terms of achievement gap and in other issues when it comes to equity in education?
Right. I would say that's one of the most frustrating and concerning pieces for us right now. But it also, there's a layer of optimism, which I'll describe to you. We don't yet know the full extent of the effects that this is having on our students and families. The layer of optimism, I would say, is that schools across the state are recognizing our school year is not done. We have a lot of students who may not have the credits they need to be considered on track, might need some additional support this summer. And we are just so inspired to see so many schools across the state thinking of new and innovative summer programs to keep the learning going this summer and make sure that our students have every opportunity to get back on track and succeed in their coursework.
I was going to ask you about those two words that most students don't want to hear put together, and that's summer school.
Yes, and we understand. It's been a long school year and taken in a lot of different ways. One of the things that we're really excited to see in the high schools that, again, we have the privilege of partnering with is understanding that simply an extension of the school year probably won't lead to the outcomes that we're looking for right now. So many of our schools are really busy designing and getting ready to implement, for example, their summer bridge programs, thinking about how do we welcome the rising ninth graders into the high school communities. And for some of these students, they haven't been in the school setting in 14 months. So that typically scary transition into high school now has all sorts of added anxieties attached to it. And we are seeing that educators are not simply saying, okay, what are the math and English courses that we're going to offer this summer, but really thinking outside of the box and saying relationships and connections to the school community are so central to everything that we do. So how do we prioritize building those strong relationships between students and their peers, between students and their teachers? How do we think about elective courses and courses that allow students to explore their passions and really spark that re-engagement to school and the learning process that was certainly affected by the pandemic? So I really think that this is a moment where it's not simply how do we extend the model of September through June into the summer months, but how do we find unique and new ways that re-engage students and also give the educators some opportunity to mix things up for themselves, too. They've been working really hard and are remaining deeply committed to do whatever it takes for their students, but finding new ways for them to make those connections as we wrap up this school year and look ahead to the next year.
And what you're describing, what you described just then, that's connected with the recommendations that are contained in the report, recommendations to policymakers to deal with some of the negative impacts of the pandemic.
That's right, exactly. And one of the things that we were trying to do in that section is really shine a light on, unfortunately, there isn't a silver bullet solution. If we do one thing, miraculously, we will be in a better position. But I would say the overarching takeaway, hopefully from that section of the report, is the need to be constantly creative and nimble, think outside the box when it feels like we're to the bottom of the toolkit. Like, how do you reach deeper? And we really tried to shine a light on some of the exciting things that we were seeing that educators, students themselves were leading in schools across the network. So there are recommendations in there that might seem kind of simple, but are still pretty out of the box and pretty neat in what they represent. So things like meeting students and families where they are in this moment of a really difficult school year. So our partners in Middletown High School, again, they were seeing a similar trend where remote students were struggling at a higher rate relative to their hybrid peers. So they've had a 4-day-a-week model, and on Wednesdays, they are asynchronous. So the teachers were meeting together, looking at the data and saying, we have students that need extra support. And rather than doing the traditional phone calls home and sort of the stock strategies that we usually do, the teachers hit the road. And they went out on Wednesdays to meet with students and families to truly understand what are the barriers to engaging in school, and then how can we work together to address those barriers. So just a really nice example of schools and families working together in even deeper partnership as a result of the pandemic. Another thing that we saw that was, again, really inspiring to see across schools is offering students second chances and multiple opportunities to demonstrate their mastery and engagement in the learning process. And through that, really forging these personal relationships between students and educators. So in Meriden, the two schools that we partner with there, Platt and Maloney High Schools, they too saw this trend for their remote learners and opened up these Saturday sessions where they would invite students in who were off track to meet one-on-one with educators. And they really prioritized remote learners and had conversations with families to say, we understand the decision not to come in during the school week, but what if on the weekend we offered a more socially distanced one-on-one support setting for your students? And they've seen tremendous turnout from students and families participating in those alternate options to get back on track. So I think both of those examples, and there are countless others, speak to the need to be responsive to student and family needs and to just remain really creative and nimble in this moment.
Can anyone get a look at that report? Is there an online place to go?
Absolutely. If you go to ctrise.org, you'll be able to access the plugged-in report.
Ms. Palin, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Emily Palin is the executive director of Connecticut Rise Network in New Haven. Just about everyone connected with or having an interest in our education system has concerns about how the loss of in-person classroom learning during the pandemic may have compromised education equity and perhaps worsened an achievement gap or an opportunity gap, as some call it, the disparity in learning between groups of students. And with me now is a guest who's been monitoring this issue. Dia Bryant is the interim executive director at the Education Trust New York, which works to eliminate gaps in equity and opportunity for students in the state of New York. Ms. Bryant, welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
Certainly. Thank you. The Education Trust has been polling parents about their children's academic development during the pandemic. I'm wondering, is that how you're keeping watch on the effect the pandemic's had on issues of equity in education? And if there is indeed a worsening achievement and opportunity gap?
Yeah, it's definitely one of the ways. We don't talk much about an achievement gap because we think it's a bit of a misnomer. We talk a lot about opportunity gaps so that we can put the onus on the systems that are meant to serve our students.
And could you talk a little bit more about that? What defining the difference or drilling down into the difference between using those two words, opportunity as opposed to achievement?
Absolutely. So the primary difference is that the achievement gap is really about measuring academic performance, right? And so we know state assessments, interim assessments, both formative and summative, are the ways that we sort of measure and sort of think about, well, what neighborhoods, what types of students are doing well, so to speak. And that kind of puts the onus and the disparities that exist within our systems as a result of systemic oppression and systemic racism on our students and not on the systems that are meant to serve them. Opportunity gaps is more about, you know, how do our government agencies, our educational systems show up for students and provide opportunities to every student in every community? And we know that that really is the crux of why we see differing performance. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes, absolutely. So polling is one of the ways you keep an eye on the opportunity gap. And you were about to say there are other ways you do that too. Could you elaborate?
We actually look very deeply at state level data and data that is publicly available through census or at the state level around attendance, around enrollment. Particularly this year during the pandemic, we did a deep dive into exceptions or exemptions for statewide regions. I will also name that during the pandemic, I think we've conducted about 5 or 6 polls. And that's been incredibly important because there's nothing normal about the last year we've had. And so hearing from parents and communities, we are really getting a better pulse on what's actually happening in the communities and how they're experiencing pandemic school closures. And there's been some very interesting findings. More than anything, I think parents are incredibly concerned that their children are falling, what they say is academically behind. I think there's also lots of concern about the student's development, both emotionally and socially, and how that will sort of pan out after the pandemic. And much of these numbers are being driven by parents of color.
You mentioned emotional and social concerns. We've talked to a few other folks during this program. That has not come up. Is that something that will need addressing, unlike it's been addressed in the past, if at all, really? I think that's something that's sort of taken for granted in some school situations.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when we look at schools in our most poverty-stricken areas where there are high concentrations of students from low-income backgrounds, high concentrations of students of color, those from multilingual families, we know for sure that those schools were under-resourced even before the pandemic. And if we look at how the pandemic has hit certain communities, we know that those same communities have been disproportionately impacted by pandemic deaths, right? I think there was a piece in August of 2020 by the United Hospital Fund that had predicted that about 4,200 students or children in New York State had lost a caregiver. Now, could you imagine when those students return back to school, the type of care that they will need? So it is more than time, and it's more than important for us to ensure that we have mental health supports for students in schools. Sort of beyond your typical guidance counselor, we're going to need some serious support for both students and their families.
Are you seeing evidence that that will indeed occur, especially in communities where the resources were thin prior to the pandemic? Is the New York State budget, for example, something that's coming down with resources for that?
Yeah, definitely. I'm hopeful. I mean, given sort of the restoration of foundation aid in New York State, as well as historic amounts from the federal government, within those allocations, there's about 20% that has to be set aside specifically for the types of supports that students will need. For example, mental health. I think there is also some other things that are moving. I mean, in New York, we see the expansion of community schools. And these are schools where we know the wraparound services are built in and that families and students have some opportunity to contribute and say what they need. And so I am hopeful that we'll use this a bit as a bit of a launch pad or a down payment on ensuring that our children have the social emotional supports as well as the academic supports. And this is important. I myself, I grew up in Detroit. I am a product of poverty and happened to work in some of the most poverty-stricken areas as a teacher and principal in New York. And what we know is that our social emotional health is tethered to our academic success. I don't know if you've ever had shoes that were too small, but it's really hard to sit in a class with shoes that hurt or hungry. And so there are some things that we're going to have to really think about in terms of our students' well-being as they transition back to the classroom. I think it's also true of their parents. This is going to be a transition that we're going to go through for at least the next year.
You used the term wraparound services before. Is that what you mean by wraparound services, these sort of additional needs that are typically not addressed in many communities?
Absolutely. And I think it is often overlooked, the value of such services, you know, the value of high quality nurses in schools, the value of high quality psychologists, the value of a restorative discipline policy. These things teach our students to be emotionally intelligent and express their emotions in ways that are productive and that actually connect to them being more agile in the academic realm as well.
I'm speaking with Dia Bryant, the interim executive director at the Education Trust New York. Ms. Bryant, you mentioned before having done 5 polls during the pandemic. Were those spaced out from early in the pandemic to recently, and did they deal with similar questions so that you could sort of track the progress or lack thereof as far as education goes?
Of course. You know, we are the data folks, so lots of tracking questions. And one of the biggest tracking questions was sort of, are you concerned about your child's overall well-being? And we've seen over and over and over that parents are consistently concerned with that. Our most recent poll was in March of 2021. And about a year ago, we did one just at the start of the pandemic. And throughout the pandemic, we've asked lots of questions about reopening, about whether or not parents wanted assessments, about their family's health, and about sort of what they think of remote learning and some of the inconsistent in-person learning that many of the districts throughout the state have had.
Did the poll results indicate progress, lack of progress? What were the differences that you saw as the pandemic went on? And what did it tell you about the way parents were feeling, about what was happening with their kids?
I think there's some really strong trends, right? And so one that we saw pretty consistently was that children who were participating in remote learning were not getting regular feedback from their educators. Now, I can say that in our October poll, about 42% reported that they didn't know how their child was doing academically. And then in March, 52% reported that they, you know, were a little bit more satisfied. I think what's happening is just a disconnect between what parents say they need and what they want and what schools and school systems are actually providing. And that goes from everywhere from like content and curriculum materials to extra support for academics and even resources for parents, right? Like many of our parents have really struggled during this time. I've been teaching my own kids from home. So, you know, there are things that schools and systems can provide that are low-hanging and easy to do, and parents consistently name that they were not getting them.
I should ask you, too, the polls, the respondents to the polls, were they scattered throughout New York State?
Statewide.
Statewide, so Long Island included, obviously.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yeah.
The results of the poll, going back to that again, what you learned from that, or what the data you collected from that, will that be forwarded to policymakers, lawmakers, Albany, the governor's office, perhaps to consider when it comes to budgeting for things that that the parents say, the school systems say, are needed to get through this?
Oh, absolutely. And I think I'll take you one further. We use these polls to brief stakeholders throughout the state, including many of the superintendents you know, and they attend these stakeholder briefings and they take the recommendations and the ideas very seriously. And this has helped us to not only inform folks like the regents and our policymakers, the education committee, It also very much informs our local advocacy and our conversations with school boards and our conversations with local organizations that are trying to sort of name something that feels a little amorphous. This helps to make it a little bit more concrete, and they can go back to their districts with data and say, hey, I'm not the only parents feeling this. 85% of Black parents feel this way, and I would like for there to be something done about it.
Well, we're just about at the end of this school year, the pandemic-filled school year. The governor has talked about full in-person learning as we move forward, Governor Cuomo. I'm wondering, from your perspective, although this seems to be the end of at least the perhaps the worst part of the pandemic, where is the education system moving forward? Is this the end of something, the middle of something, the beginning of something?
I think we're in all three. And let me just name it this way. I think that coming out of the pandemic, we have a unique opportunity to meet the needs across variations, right? And so there have been children that have thrived in remote learning. I would argue that has not been the majority of children. There are children who have not liked it at all. My daughter can't stand it. And then there are folks who have made other choices. What I think we're at now is a bit of an inflection point where we actually have to think about public education as a public good, where the public should be able to weigh in and say, this is what my family needs, this is why, and I'm gonna demand it. And so I think we're moving away from a one size fits all. I think we're gonna move toward fitting the contexts of families, of communities a little bit better. And to be honest with you, I think this is the beginning of remote learning. I think that there's an opportunity to fortify it and to make it high quality for folks, not just in our state, but across the country, and really spread information a little bit better. And I'll use this as an example. Course access, which is sort of the availability of advanced coursework for students throughout the state, is a big issue. There are many students that attend schools that have not one AP course or not one advanced course at all. And we know for sure that these courses are the gateway into high quality colleges and high quality courses when you land in college, meaning that you would be able to skip sort of the remediation and the co-requisite spaces. Remote learning actually offers an opportunity for us to have those for everybody just through a simple Zoom link. So I think there's some opportunities here. I think we have to be careful about them. I think we need more research around them. And more than anything, I think we need to be listening to parents and students and families and educators and getting around tables and saying, what do we need to support students in reaching their desired future?
Ms. Bryant, thanks so much for your time and insights today. We appreciate it.
Of course. It's a pleasure.
Dia Bryant is the Interim Executive Director at the Education Trust, New York. We're exploring the impact of the pandemic on students and their education, and we really can't do that without understanding the perspectives of parents as well. What did they discover as they monitored their kids going through remote or hybrid learning? Joining me now on the phone is Gwen Samuel. She's the founder and president of the Connecticut Parents Union. Ms. Samuel, thanks for joining us today.
And thank you so much for having me and for representing the parents' voice.
Sure.
In this very tough time.
In fact, if you would, tell us about the Connecticut Parents Union and the mission of the union.
So the mission, in a nutshell, is to protect the educational rights of children, because every child in the state of Connecticut, regardless of school model, has a constitutional right to a safe and quality education. Our job is to work with parents and families. We work with them, not for them, to ensure better outcomes for Connecticut's children and America's children as a whole, because we're in this world together.
And I would imagine that you've heard quite a bit from parents during the pandemic about how their kids took to or didn't take to the various learning options that Connecticut schools made available to their students during the pandemic.
Well, it's interesting because the options were still very limited, right? So we went from January 2020, Happy New Year's, to now we're closing the country down because of a pandemic.
Mm.
And one thing that was noticed from the very beginning is that schools didn't have a great handle on communicating with all of its parents, right? Because if you think about traditional schools, for the most part, there are parents who are not just traditional schools, schooling in general. You have those parents that are more hands-on than others. That could be because of work, life challenges, or just that parent needing some of the support. So one of the number one challenges that school districts and the state as a whole was even communicating effectively with parents to let them know about the pandemic. And then fast forward, then as solutions came to address the learning loss that was beginning to happen, we were like, okay, everyone, we're just going to go remote. We're just going to go on the internet. Lo and behold, everyone didn't have internet access. Some couldn't afford it. Some lost it because they couldn't afford to pay the bill. Some didn't have the community, you know, internet in their communities for whatever reason. So we saw very quickly the inequities that existed depending on what zip code you were in Connecticut. So that was like the number one challenge for parents. They felt very, very disconnected from the decision makers that were making decisions on the fly at that time. And I'm talking about the very beginning of the pandemic.
And what was the feeling, the reaction of parents in terms of their way of responding to it? Was it frustration? Was it action oriented? Did you get a feeling for that?
So there was, I would call it a hybrid. We like to use that term since the pandemic. So there were a hybrid of emotions and input. For some parents that really had a handle on their children, right? They knew their children, their lifestyle, their learning abilities. Some just jump right in to fill in the gap. That's why I distinguish homeschooling and schooling at home. Some of us were schooling at home, then there were those who were literally homeschooling. And so there was a mixture. So some parents that understood it or had a better handle on it, they jumped right in. They said, we're just going to fill in the gaps. Here are the workbooks we have, or this was the last homework assignment. So we had those types of parents who were able to jump right in. There were those who just kind of winged it, right? Paid attention to the internet, if they had the internet, or to their neighbors, just trying to figure it out. And then there were those who started to, who either worked so much, and because jobs were closed, because the state was closed, some really got to know their children better than they thought they knew. So they had these feelings of guilt. So there were a lot of parents, I'm talking lots of them, who felt like, oh my goodness, I thought I knew my child's learning levels. Were they reading at goal? I'm learning my child all over again. So some families learning together of what they did know about education, what they didn't know, and kind of winging it. So, and then parents finding that they were more in tune with their children than not. So there were some parents who were like, okay, I didn't know this was happening. Here the cards were being dealt with. We're going to work through them. Still needing guidance from the state, mind you, but that wasn't really happening at that time. So there were some parents finding self-esteem, some just needing more supports, and then some just jumping in. So it was a hybrid of emotions, guilt, success, and trying to figure it out, trial and error.
So as we approach the end of the school year, well, the traditional school year anyway, some are talking about things like summer school. But as we approach, you know, the end of June when kids are typically getting out of K through 12 school, are parents still in that sort of hybrid division in terms of their feelings about how well the kids did? Are they worried about the children falling behind in their schoolwork due to the way the pandemic was handled in terms of their education?
Oh, absolutely. There are parents who still do not want to send their children back to school because now that some parents have gotten a handle on what their kids should be learning, some feel that the schools that they used to attend may not be the proper fit. There's another group out there that families that have medical conditions They are concerned about sending their kids back, so they're looking for virtual schools. So what we are hearing is options are needed more than ever. And I'm not talking the rhetoric that we usually do pre-pandemic. We're talking about looking at the pandemic, looking at this unpredictability, looking at how unprecedented it was, and finding the best fit that not only meets the child's needs, but meets the household needs. Because one thing I'm noticing parents are saying, now that I have a better handle on working with my child, but those that are more in tune do not want to go back to business as usual. So the challenges we're facing is parents are wanting more options, especially special education children. And even though we have schools that have opened back up, the kids already lost about a year of learning. And so parents have concern that you're just dropping them into the next grade, hoping for the best that they're at grade level or they're at goal, versus assessing where the child is now, how much learning loss has occurred, and what supports need to be in place to ensure not only that they help get caught up, right, get back on track, but to stay on track. And I was on a call with the Commissioner of Education and some other leaders with the State Department of Education last week, and the goal was to move from just surviving the pandemic to thriving in the pandemic, but also transforming, and which to me sounds kind of rhetoric, but I get the spirit. So there are mixed feelings right now. Some people are welcoming the schools are opening and sending their kids back. Some are saying, nope, there's too many variables and unknowns, and we don't want to send them back, so we should have options to include virtual schools, to include continuing remote learning. And then there are those who are just saying, I'm going to take my chance at homeschooling. I got a better handle on my child's education, and I don't think the current system, to include the pandemic, can give my child what they need. And there are hundreds of after-school programs, if I'm understanding correctly from the state, that are supposed to be, that have formed, that have applied for grant monies through this historical monies from the American Rescue Plan. But again, there are still too many unknowns because the kids have lost so much time in a traditional classroom or instructional hours that the parents are feeling that just thrusting them back in may not get them where they need to be.
I'm speaking with Gwen Samuel, the founder and president of the Connecticut Parents Union. Are there ideas for ways to discover the unknowns, to uncover them, find out what they are, and then put in place some specific options, parents looking for options that yes. would address that?
Yes. Number one, again, when I look at the state's efforts, and they're the state, so they do have a statutory obligation to all 500,000 children in the state of Connecticut. But where they need to do a better job is actually communicating with the communities, because you cannot dismiss the year of parents building new relationships, developing community remote learning hubs, right? There were a lot of things that the communities had to take initiative to do to support learning curves and learning loss, the achievement. We're not even going to call it a gap. We're talking achievement gulfs, right? We're talking opportunity gulfs that are existing. And the state needs to do a better job at communicating with the communities that these children live in. It was a challenge pre-pandemic, so I kind of find it funny that you're still finding it a challenge. You're shocked that you have this gap between communication when you had it before. So one of the number one solutions is to really do some community mapping, assessing what currently exists, partner with those entities, right? Holding individuals and entities accountable. There is not enough accountability talk. We're talking pouring in money, but we do not hear the checks and balances. Because if something is not working, then we need to do a corrective course immediately. We shouldn't spend the money, this historical money, because once it's spent, it is gone. So we have to be better stewards of being fiscally responsible and ensuring that these are real-time solutions meeting real-time challenges, because we're dealing with real children in real life.
Are you at all concerned about Governor Lamont's budget when it comes to state funding to public schools. Is there enough money available from the state, from other sources perhaps as well, to fund some of the efforts that you're describing that would address these problems?
Yes. So I do have concerns with, because again, you're seeing this money, like it's just pouring in, and we're talking about new hires, and we're talking about new positions, right? Once this money is spent, then you're going to have to sustain the bigger government, right? Which we were already having budget challenges prior to the pandemic. So I do have concerns that we're just creating these new, I call them flavor of the months, right? Things that make us feel good on the inside, but do they actually translate to success? We had many things that could have worked prior to the pandemic if we partnered more effectively with communities. So I do have concerns that they're seeing this windfall of money as we have a lot of money to do with what we want. It's not about just doing anything. It's about being able to sustain it. And we shouldn't just be doing, like I said, what just sounds good, catchy flavors, catchy slogans. We need to center the child in public education and then look at what the child needs and then implement the solutions. We're one of the wealthiest states in the nation with some of the most prestigious universities and thought leaders and parent leaders and student leaders and community leaders across the country. There is no way that we cannot figure this out without putting ourselves more in debt, because I see debt coming. It's already here, but I see it coming if you're just going to build new programs versus looking at what's working, supporting them to bring them to scale, and then just put real-time solutions on the ground to get these children caught up and sustained.
I have one more question, and it's about the Connecticut Parents Union itself. Has the pandemic changed the advocacy work that your group does?
Yes.
Has it made what you do more urgent? What changes has the pandemic brought to your group?
Yes, so there's two things. So number one, there is, we usually are issue specific. So there's an issue, we jump in. The problem is the issue is impacting all, regardless of race, regardless of income. We have middle-class families that have now lost family businesses, that are now embarking on public school journeys. So just so many things. So that means the demand has been greater, and we don't have that capacity. So we're looking more intentional at our partnerships, at our relationships, because we don't need to be all things to all people. We just need to be more effective in our partnering with community entities and other parent groups and other newly formed groups so that we can help local cities understand their needs, because we are statewide, but it's hard to work statewide. So because of the need is greater than our capacity. But we are doing better at relationship building and community mapping, and making sure that entities on the ground have the information that they need to meet the needs of their parents and students in their own community. No one should have to travel from Stanford to work with I'm Meriden, but we are statewide, just to get a need met. They should be able to get those needs met in their own community. But again, this is not working for someone. It's working with. And that's what the state needs to do better at, understanding that parents and community leaders are relationships that need to be built so that we can build partnerships. We are not partners automatically because all things are not equal. But communicating and being transparent and being accountable will help meet the needs. And so that has been our challenge, is the capacity and the need has been greater than we have the capacity for, but we're more effective at working with people on the ground. So that has been our strength with the Connecticut Parents Union.
Ms. Samuel, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
And thank you so much, and we look forward to retweeting this segment and let it get trending on Twitter.
Great. Gwen Samuel is the founder and president of the Connecticut Parents Union. Teachers, of course, were on the front lines during the pandemic, and being an essential worker has taken its toll. So how are teachers in Connecticut doing as the school year comes to an end? Joining me now on Skype is Dr. Donald Paris. He's an education consultant and has trained teachers for 37 years as an associate professor of special education at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven. Professor Paris, welcome back to The Full Story.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tom. It's my pleasure.
Certainly. Sort of a wide open, broad question to begin with. What are you hearing from teachers about this past school year? Have you been able to be in touch with some of them as the school year comes to a close?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the answer is yes on both accounts. Starting this January, February, I've been involved in some virtual coaching, and surprisingly, in the city of Philadelphia, where I've also done some on-site coaching the past few years. So just using that group of teachers, it's evident to me that this is a huge challenge, partly for two obvious reasons. Many of the veteran teachers have not had any preparation for this transitional kind of teaching with remote and hybrid. And I think the second reason is obvious. The students are much more impacted by dividing their attention between being at home versus being at school. I don't think teacher training has really focused on this kind of reality, certainly not coming into 2021. Going forward, I'm optimistic that that's going to improve for the coming school year.
When you say that the teachers who have been in the system for a longer time weren't prepared or weren't brought up to speed, I guess, on mm-hmm. this approach, are you talking more of a technical kind of a thing, or just the concept of splitting between in person and away from the building?
Yeah, I think the technology is something that can be mastered. I'm almost certain all districts have allocated a lot of resources to bring everyone up to at least a common level of skill. I'm a little bit more concerned about what I would call the psychological or emotional bonding with the students, particularly when they reach middle or high school, because then you're coping with adolescence and a whole variety of other issues. The teachers that I've spoken with this spring, that's been their bigger concern. How do you attain the students' attention? Can you keep them focused and engaged? Are the students giving full effort? How legitimate is their work? So there's a multiple list of questions. And I do think this will evolve over the summer as we get prepared for kind of in-person instruction starting in September.
We've been talking during this program with other folks about sort of where things stand as far as the education system being changed or revised as a result of the pandemic. This is the end of a school year, but where does the system, generally speaking, educational system, stand in relation to that? Is this the beginning of something new? Is it the middle of something that's changing? Or is it the end of something old that is now going away?
I'm going to argue, and I think there's some evidence to support this. We'll use Connecticut, for example. Mm-hmm. There's a whole program being forwarded by the state. It's called Accelerate Connecticut. And this is a novel plan that's going to encompass the whole learning environment of school, the community engagement, hiring capable and functional teachers who are skilled in this model. So I do think this is kind of a positive energy that's going to catapult us into the next year. Now, logically, anything that's new is going to have some serious repercussions until we master the basics. But if I'm any district that I'm familiar with in our state, the majority of faculty will be prepared. Now the issue is, will the students return to school, be able to behave, to socialize, will understand the rhythms and the responsibilities of being in person? That's going to create a little drama, and I'm using my word, over the first month or so. So I think this is a transition, but I do believe it's a positive direction.
Is that something that teachers will need additional instruction training on, the kids being acclimated once again to in-person versus the at-home learning?
Oh, I definitely think so, because the academic demands are going to be, as the term implies, accelerated. We're going to try to emphasize personalized learning for all students, regardless of their skills or backgrounds. That's going to take a lot more energy, preparation. Teachers are going to have to be skilled in differentiating their lesson plans and activities. So that alone is going to be a fairly significant change. And then, as I said, we're now going to need more training in behavior management, just learning to cope with students who have had trauma, experienced poverty since they've been at home, lack of resources. So I do think this is going to be a significant shift for a lot of people.
I'm not a teacher, but I got to tell you, that sounds overwhelming, what they'll need to take on in a normal day-to-day situation in the classroom.
Since this January, February, as I mentioned at the start, I've designed a couple of webinars on teacher mental health, which are available on YouTube. And that impulse occurred because of all the, quote, complaints from the teachers I was consulting with, mostly, again, about their bonding and relationships with the students, which, by the way, is the most critical aspect of the entire educational system. If we have capable, emotionally stable, highly energetic, and committed educators, then any model, quite theoretically at least, can be implemented successfully. Unfortunately, a lot of districts are struggling finding staff, that's first, and then finding staff in critical areas like math, science, and special education in particular, because of that responsibility. So yeah, I do think there's going to be a significant need to engage teachers in this whole different approach.
When we spoke earlier, back in October, I believe it was, you mentioned even then there was a struggle to find substitute teachers since many of the regular staff didn't want to enter the building. So what you're saying now is, just generally speaking, it's not easy for school districts to find staff on any level.
Yeah, this is a national dilemma. In fact, I actually spoke on this topic at an international conference that had the same concerns we have in the United States. There's a decline in the number of people attending teacher training programs, that's first. And then we have all the realities of being a teacher. There's a certain like loneliness and sense of self involved when you're in a classroom. Even if the kids are shifting every 15 minutes, then you're constantly adjusting to personalities, to skill levels, to their respect for authority. So it has a lot of dimensions to it that are really complicated. I'm a little concerned, just being in the field so long, where are we going to attract, or how are we going to attract the next generation of young people coming into the field? I do think this is a serious challenge.
The teachers that you've spoken with, how do they feel about their school systems? Do they feel the districts are giving them the support they need, or is it lacking?
I'm going to say that's a transitional kind of answer, simply because, again, the superintendents are adjusting their thinking process, their allocation of resources, and so forth. So this is a transformational period. So I think the answer varies from point to point. Certainly, I think the very affluent districts will at least have the resources that can accommodate this type of shift. I think the country as a whole is quite concerned about some of the urban communities who really need to have additional funding and hire a staggering number of staff, like psychologists, social workers, and so forth, to kind of approach this new requirement.
I think you mentioned the word optimism before. Are you optimistic about the ability of, well, the Connecticut system, and I guess generally speaking, the educational system in the country, to move forward and to get beyond this and bring students up to speed with the help of well-prepared teachers and well-informed parents?
Yeah. Some of the new vocabulary out there now, they speak in terms of high-quality instruction. Everything is about having diverse staffing, giving kids training in social emotional learning. So we're not just talking about, quote, academics in that sense of the term. Education now is much more broad-based. We're dealing holistically with the entire child from kindergarten to 12th grade. And you can imagine the complexity of that assignment. And unfortunately, a number of students are coming to us lacking what I call readiness. They either have not had the preparation for school, or they haven't had the motivation and the energy and the discipline to succeed at school until we help them master the basics. So even a kindergartner now is going to be exposed to a wide range of academic responsibilities that did not exist 20 or 30 years ago.
How much change do you think there will need to be in teacher training at colleges, universities that offer that course in order to accommodate the needs, the new needs of kids?
I'll tell you one thing that I would emphasize. We have to give teachers a sense of what I call their personality and the sense of who they are as an individual. I don't think teacher training focuses on the self part of the job. And to me, as I just mentioned, that's the most important dynamic every day between teacher and students. So when I do coaching, I'm constantly asking teachers to be reflective, to keep weekly logs about their engagement with students, to develop some self-care activities to nurture their emotional balance and composure. A lot of teacher training is still focused on the academia, which is critical, obviously, but this is a self-related profession, and that's why I think it's become more demanding than in the past.
Dr. Paris, thank you once again for your insights on the subject. We appreciate your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Dr. Donald Paris is a Connecticut-based education consultant. We've talked today about ways to improve public education as we emerge from the pandemic. Of course, it'll cost money to implement new ideas that will actually help students, lots of money in some cases. Where will the funding come from once federal pandemic relief runs out? One option is public-private partnerships. But to understand how that could work, we should understand how it doesn't work. About 2 years ago, Connecticut tried to launch a large-scale, multi-million-dollar partnership with the Dalio Foundation. It was dubbed the Connecticut Partnership for Education, but the project fell apart rather quickly. WSHU's senior political reporter Ebong Udama covered the short life of that partnership and has taken now a new look at what happened to it. Ebong joins me in person in our studio. Ebong, welcome back to in-person interviews. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Well, what was the Connecticut Partnership for Education?
Well, it was the brainchild of Ray Dalio, who's a hedge fund billionaire who lives in Greenwich, Connecticut. And he came up with this idea. His wife has been very actively involved in public education in Connecticut for years. And they came up with this idea of going really big. And
how big when we're talking about?
We're talking about $100 million. Mm. And they were going to come up with $100 million. And Governor Ned Lamont liked the idea of private-public partnerships. And so the state would match the $100 million with its own $100 million. And then they would jointly go out and get other large philanthropies to contribute another $100 million. So we'd have $300 million to invest in trying to improve education and close the achievement gap in Connecticut.
And this was all pre-pandemic, of course.
Yes, it was.
Well, on the surface, that seems wonderful. Essentially a two-for-one match that winds up worth $300 million. But not everybody thought it was a good idea, right? Why not?
Well, a lot of politicians were concerned that public money was going to be given to a private entity to spend without the oversight that you would normally get when public money is spent. A lot of Republicans were upset about this, and one of them was a state representative, Vincent Candelar, who's the head of the Republican minority in the House. And this is what he had to say. This is how he described his concerns.
You know, as well-intentioned as that organization was, you know, we had individuals who are accustomed to the private sector clashing with people who operate in the public sector sphere trying to perform a public service. And, you know, with that, the same rules just don't apply to government as they do to private business. And I think it just sort of collapsed because of, in part, the way that business was structured.
So the administration then of these potentially $300 million would be overseen by a private entity?
Well, basically, they formed a board, a public-private board. Mm-hmm. But the driving force behind this was the Dalio Foundation. And private money always likes to control how it is spent. And it's a very different situation with public money, where everyone has a say. And so that clash was the big problem here.
So how did that lead to essentially the collapse of the big idea of the public-private partnership?
Well, if the Dalio Foundation wasn't able to do what they wanted to do, they didn't want to be part of it. And so they wanted to have more of a say on how the money would be spent if they were putting up $100 million. So it just didn't work out. However, the Dalio Foundation is still involved in education in Connecticut, but on a much smaller scale now.
And the big partnership idea that collapsed middle of 2020, roughly sometime in after the start of the pandemic?
It collapsed after the start of the pandemic. But by that time, the first initiative of this partnership had already been launched, which was providing laptops for students who could not otherwise afford laptops so that it could be engaged in online learning. And that came in very handy during the pandemic.
So there was some positive news
that was a silver lining
from the partnership. In your reporting, have you gotten any sense of how this largely negative public-private partnership, at least as it was imagined at the beginning, this experience may affect potential efforts in the future of this size and even of smaller scale partnerships? I understand there are some that are working, smaller public-private partnerships that are funding educational needs around the state?
Yes, they are. And last summer I was in Norwalk, and they had a partnership that provided funding so that they could have broadband to homes that otherwise would not have been able to afford it. And there were several private philanthropies that were involved in that. It was smaller scale. We were talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars here and not $100 million.
So more manageable.
Targeted, more manageable. And instead of having a situation where you had a private entity involved in education throughout the state of Connecticut, it was specific programs in specific schools or specific school districts.
What about transparency, even with the smaller partnerships? Is that still an issue when you've got a private partner that is used to not necessarily divulging all the information about what's happening with its money?
Well, basically what you have is with smaller amounts of money, there are specific programs that generally are generated by the public schools themselves. So they go out and they have this specific need, and that is funded. So that way you don't have a situation where you have a pot of money and now you have people trying to decide how they want to use it.
So it sounds like a public-private partnership option on a smaller scale is an option that that could see some light and further use down the road in Connecticut. And also in Fairfield County, just this week, I believe, there was a grant of...
Yep, several private foundations got together, and they're funding seven different programs in Fairfield County.
Education programs, specific education programs.
And the first round was $300,000 that was just announced last week.
Ebong, thanks for coming in and sharing this information with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Tom. Nice to see you.
You too. Ebong Udama is WSHU's senior political reporter, and he produced this Connecticut education coverage in partnership with the Solutions Journalism Network. You can hear his full reports. It's on our website at WSHU.org. How about you? How did you get through the school year? Let us know. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org, and we're on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU. That's it for our program today. Produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez, I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.